I'm Kay Firth Butterfield at the World Economic Forum.
And I'm Miriam Vogel with Equal AI. And this is In AI We Trust. Hello, and welcome back to In AI We Trust. Today, we are so pleased to be joined by Dr. Mickey Tripathi, National Coordinator for Health Information Technology at the Department of Health and Human Services. In this role, Dr. Tripathi leads the formulation of federal health IT strategy and coordinates federal health IT policies, standards, programs, and investments. Prior to this role, Dr. Tripathi was Chief Alliance Officer for Arcadia, a healthcare data and software company, and before that, President and Chief Executive Officer of Massachusetts eHealth Collaborative, and several other important institutions that he has served on as board member and has been a fellow, including the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. He also was a board member at HL7, the Sequoia Project, the Commonwealth Health Alliance, and others. Dr. Tripathi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
Well, thank you. Dr. Tripathi, your work is in the hotspot. It's at the intersection of healthcare and technology. How did this unique space first become of interest to you?
Yeah, a very, very circuitous path for sure. And not one that I would have anticipated. Well, first off, I've always been really interested in the intersection of business, science, technology, policy. And even though all my formal education is in political science, I also did a bunch of quantitative analysis work, statistics. I was pre-med, so kind of started off with that science and policy side. And then I worked in the Pentagon for a number of years, where, of course, you have that same kind of intersection of business, science, technology, and those areas have always sort of interested me. And then I got into consulting. We started doing some work in Indianapolis, where this is like in late 90s, early 2000, where there seemed to be opportunities where you have a intersection of academia, industry, and government, where they could develop synergies in ways that might help a business environment or business ecosystem move forward. So we had gone to Indianapolis. We were hired as consultants. I was at the Boston Consulting Group. And we were hired to come in and look at some industry areas. One of them was some of the work that was being done at the Regenstrief Institute that's connected with the IU School of Medicine. And they were doing some really groundbreaking work. They still are in informatics and bringing data together from various hospital systems and starting to think about how that might be valuable. That got me started as we worked on that. We developed a business plan for what eventually became a nonprofit entity called the Indiana Health Information Exchange. And having done that for a few years in my consulting role, the bug bit me at that point and was really excited about the opportunity ahead in health information technology. Of course, it was like the year 2000, 2001. So we still didn't have adoption of health records, but it seemed like there was going to be something really interesting and fascinating there. And big efforts started in Massachusetts, my home state, that gave me the opportunity to leave consulting and really dive into an activity that was the Mass eHealth Collaborative that got us started.
Fantastic. So many good things coming from Massachusetts. And before we dive into the specifics of some of your work, I want to help set the framework on some of your big picture values and areas of priority. And in your career, you have championed greater use and access to healthcare data as a means to improve the healthcare system generally. Big picture, how do you see AI affecting the use of data to improve care and to improve the lives of patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a number of dimensions. One is the ability to use AI, in effect, as like an analytic and translation tool to be able to make sense of data in much more facile ways than we're able to right now using current techniques, and to broaden the scope of the type of information that we can make intelligible. So you think about the vast amount of unstructured data that exists in the healthcare delivery system today, which we really make very little use of at scale. And I think the opportunity to bring in AI and machine learning as a tool or a suite of tools that helps us take that data, make better sense of it, and make it actionable, I think is one area of huge opportunity. The other is in helping better integration and workflows than we have today. I mean, again, you know, data is really hard to use, and it's really difficult to make data, whether it was structured or unstructured, you know, sort of available in workflows. And I think what we've seen with the opportunities that just ChatGPT offers in way of convenience and of availability and access you can imagine that there are different ways of thinking about the human-machine interaction and what that might say about the usability of systems in the future. The last thing I would point to is the ability of patients to be able to interpret their medical records for themselves, to be able to better understand that and to become more of an engaged partner in their own healthcare. There's a very well-known physician who I'm not sure if he tells this story publicly, so I won't reveal his name, but he's very deep in informatics as well. And he describes an episode where through the use of regulations that ONC has put in place regarding a patient's ability to access all of their medical records, unstructured and structured data, his ability to exercise that to get all of his records, including, and he had just gone through surgery and a bunch of things for an acute illness that he's going through now. And so he was able to get like the operative notes and stuff that would just would have been deep textual stuff that was, you know, kind of impenetrable. Certainly for a lay patient to be able to look through and understand it just would have been something that, you know, A, wouldn't have really had access to, and B, would have had a very difficult time interpreting. Anyway, fast forward, he got all of those records. He ran them through ChatGPT and got, he said, an amazing summary and interpretation of all of that in a way. Now, he's a clinician, so he was, you know, but he intentionally tried to get it to say something in sort of plain language terms. And he found it incredibly powerful, even without it being medically fine-tuned. It was just the generic ChatGPT, but just described this whole experience of getting access to that information, being able to run it through a basic general purpose LLM model, and having that both deliver a great interpretation that a layperson would have a much better ability to understand, as well as pointing out areas that may be further questions for the physician, which itself was, you know, a pretty remarkable set of findings. So I think that there's a huge opportunity there as well as we, ONC, through our regulations, but also CMS through their regulations, are requiring that more and more data be made available to patients, which of course always begs the question of, can patients make use of all of that information? I think that's going to be a really important part of our use of AI in healthcare.
Thank you so much for walking us through those three different vantage points of opportunity and landing on the patients. I think one thing I would love to follow up on is the means that you mentioned that data can add so much benefit, makes so much sense in terms of interpretability, translatability, efficiency. And I'm wondering, for all of us, we all are patients, we all are healthcare beneficiaries or recipients, how do you expect the average patient will experience some of the benefits of AI, either currently or through the work that you're doing now?
Yeah, well, I certainly hope that they see the benefits in the ways that I was describing. So that direct benefit, that'll take time, right, for it to, you know, work its way to a set of things that are available off the shelf and usable to the average person. But I think that indirectly, we in general, and I personally, are AI optimists as it relates to its uses in healthcare. And so the ability to be able to get more effective and efficiently information in the hands of clinicians for them to be able to make better decisions in ways that are better than they're able to do today, both faster and with greater accuracy, hopefully, and the ability, even from an administrative side, for us to be able to automate more things in the healthcare delivery system to get greater efficiency in a way that improves the user experience, which I think all of us have confronted as we see hyper-efficiency when we go to Starbucks or use Uber Eats or work our way through Home Depot. And then we hit the hospital or the doctor's office and all of it seems to come to a standstill. Like, what's happened here? How have I gone back 30 years? I think the opportunities for us to be able to say, wait a minute, all of that can be brought to bear in ways that improve the user experience in general. And some of which, as I said, is, you know, sort of more direct and patient facing, but hopefully the more powerful aspects of that are actually in improvement of care in ways that a patient hopefully recognizes, but in some ways which they may not recognize, but is actually there. There's a fascinating survey that I think was done by the Boston Globe, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was like 6 months ago, maybe, where they asked the question about the concerns about use of AI in healthcare. And as one might expect, there was a very high percentage who said something like, oh, they were very concerned about safe and appropriate uses of AI in healthcare, but which is fine and very consistent with a whole bunch of other polling and surveys that are out there. But the interesting part of the survey was that it asked patients, can you see a time when you would choose your providers based on their use of AI, like in a positive way, that you would want to go to providers who are able to demonstrate that they're using AI? And it was more than half I think, as I recall from that survey, that said, yes, I would do that. And I can imagine patients, I myself, my own experience, could imagine wanting to know at some point that, well, wait a minute, I would love to know that that dermatologist is not only having their own expert opinion about that mole, but that they're actually drawing on AI that was learning from a million moles and helping to inform them about, you know, giving a sense of what's the probability that this is a million mole or something that to be concerned about. And then they can apply their human judgment on top of that. I think that that's hopefully where we're headed and could be a way of being able to really see those kinds of things in a tangible way and to actually start to choose that that's what I want to make sure that my providers have.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. The more we're learning, more we're able to learn, which AI can do at a capacity, at a level, at a speed that humans cannot, the more beneficiaries from that rapid development, the more we will all see benefits and have greater health, which of course is directly in line with the mission of the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT. Can you share with those who are not as familiar what the mission is of your role and of your office?
Yeah, we're a quiet, low-profile agency that that I think punches way above our weight. So we're relatively small. We're like 180 people. We're a staff division in the Department of Health and Human Services. So most people outside of healthcare are probably just very familiar with at least the names of the big agencies in the department, like CMS, Medicare and Medicaid, NIH, FDA, CDC. Those are, you know, kind of the operating divisions. ONC is one of the staff divisions who are kind of organization peers. But as staff divisions, we are in the secretary's office at large. And what we do as a staff division is we kind of cut across all of those other operating divisions to help support them in the very particular functional areas that we have. So in the same way that the Office of General Counsel works with every one of the operating divisions from a legal perspective and from a compliance perspective, ONC works with all of those operating divisions from a health IT perspective and to help them use health information technology in the most effective ways that they can. So it's kind of a great role because we get to work with all these different operating divisions across a whole bunch of different use cases and ways that affect people's lives. So the important things that I think people may see, or either indirectly or directly, is that we certify electronic health records, for example, that are used by 97% of hospitals and about 80% of physician offices. And a part of that is establishing the data standards and things like interoperability mechanisms that are used by those EHR systems. So in your day-to-day life, where you would experience that is if you have ever gone on to the patient portal at your provider's office, the information, first off, the very fact that there is a patient portal is a requirement that came from ONC and CMS regulations. Not everyone would have a patient portal if it wasn't for ONC regulations that says certified electronic health records have to have patient access to their electronic information, and our partner CMS telling providers you have to use a certified system that has those features. Plus, the data that you see in that patient portal is actually defined in our regulations. So we establish data standards that say that minimally you have to make this information available. And then finally, we have requirements that say you need to allow a patient to be able to download their information and take it wherever they want, which is through modern APIs, for example. So you can download it into the Apple Health Record, for example, where the Apple Health Record actually uses ONC standards in the design of the Apple Health Record because they know that those standards are implemented in those systems. And that's how they can assure that if you're using the Apple Health Record in Alaska or in Florida, you can actually still get your record from the local hospital. So that's one way that we are very involved in the market itself. And then, of course, we have other kinds of regulations related to like use of AI, for example. And we just launched a nationwide network, like a network of networks to connect up clinical networks so that we can have kind of the medical internet that all of us have wanted to be able to have so that medical records go where they're needed at the right time. So that's all the external kind of stuff. What we do internally, I kind of described before, is we work with our agency partners to ensure that we have the best use of health IT within the department. And that allows us to make sure that from a taxpayer's perspective, we're getting the most bang for the buck for the taxpayer dollars, because we're trying to make sure that we're aligned around common standards and synergies across agencies. But it also allows us to be sort of good citizens in the market, because in the market, we believe strongly that organizations should be using open industry standards to communicate with each other, and that the federal government should play its part by saying we're going to use open industry standards and all the interactions that we have with the market to allow as much seamless exchange of information on behalf of the patient as we can.
Well, I have no doubt there are many people listening right now who are saying, thank goodness for the ONC. And I wish every agency had an agency like that to help with the cross-cutting IT issues and help ensure that everyone has access to the kinds of thinking that you're able to offer through your, as you say, small but mighty staff.
Well, thanks.
And I know that one area of central focus these days has been the federal executive order that President Biden issued in October. I know every agency, including HHS, is very busy making sure they are delivering on the directives in that order. And I know that one of the mandates was to create an AI task force at HHS. Can you tell us about your involvement at the task force? What is the scope and what is the current activity that we can expect to see from that task force?
Yeah, so the executive order that came out in October, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, it established broad administration policy related to AI across all federal agencies. Department was, I think, probably the second most named agency in the executive order, I think, which is just a testament to our presence. And obviously, healthcare is a big and important area that directly affects people's lives. And in many ways, the ways in which AI might affect Americans, the most profound ways could actually very well be in healthcare for all the reasons that we were describing before about the opportunities in healthcare. So we established a task force across the department. The secretary asked me to co-lead it with Dr. Syed Mohiuddin, who works in the secretary's office. And we have launched that task force that has a couple of different deliverables and tasks ahead of us. One is the deliverables that were laid out in the executive order itself. So there are very discrete kinds of deliverables that are in there that I can quickly describe in a second. But more generally, what we've done, and this is partly because with the secretary's office, we were working on establishing this task force even before the executive order was sort of being developed. So it was really almost a year ago that within the department, we were looking at AI and algorithms and use in healthcare and seeing that we were going to need to get out ahead of this in the department. So we were already putting together the idea and the concept of having a department-wide task force covering a variety of different areas. Then, of course, the White House got started on the executive order. We kind of put that on hold while we worked with the White House on the executive order. And now the executive order is baked into the way we're thinking about the task force so that they're fully aligned and that the task force itself is assuring that we're meeting those deliverables as well as, you know, sort of the broader approach that we want to be able to take here. So we cover eight areas that we identified, and even before the executive order, that are areas that the task force needs to cover generally. And those are research and discovery, drug and device approval and development, healthcare and human services delivery, public health, critical infrastructure and cybersecurity, biosafety and biosecurity, ethical and responsible use of AI, and then finally, use of AI in HHS internal operations. So those are kind of eight broad areas. We've established work groups in each of those areas, and they're hard at work at now working on the various deliverables that we have. The very specific deliverables, and I can go over these very quickly. I don't want to bore you, but we have a set of deliverables in April that are identified in the executive order. One is related to a strategy for quality assurance of AI systems used in healthcare. And the initial focus is on the FDA use case, which is pre and post-market approval processes and safety monitoring. But it'll, you know, broaden to other considerations of the healthcare as well. There is also a report that we're developing on the uses of AI in public benefits programs that are administered by the secretary. There is work that the NIH is doing to support the biosecurity framework that is led by the White House Office of Science, Technology, and Policy related to synthetic nucleic acid screening in the biosecurity framework. And then finally, there will be additional considerations related to non-discrimination in the use of AI in healthcare settings, which is kind of building on what the Office of Civil Rights has already done with what's called Section 1557, which is non-discrimination in healthcare activities generally. So that's kind of the first set of deliverables that we're working on. And then fast forward to October, there is in many ways the big deliverable, which is an HHS strategic plan regarding the use of AI in healthcare. So kind of an umbrella strategic plan that covers all of the areas, as well as a specific strategy related to drug discovery and a specific strategy related to safety monitoring in the use of AI. So pretty broad scope, very ambitious, but fortunately we've got the chassis built for the task force and they're well underway.
It's hard to imagine too much more than that. Each one sounds like a full-time job between AI and research, drug approvals, public health benefits, biosafety. I mean, it's ethics, internal infrastructure.
A lot of those areas are areas that we as a society, and this is public and private, barely have scratched the surface of our understanding of some of these things. So we just all need to recognize that what we want to do as a department is say, we are preparing ourselves so that we are ahead of this, but we also recognize that we are probably going to be broader than we are deep in a lot of these areas, which is to say, we want to have something to say in all of those areas and create a framework for thinking about it. But in some areas, it may be that we don't have that much more to say about a particular area because we as an industry, whether it's Silicon Valley or, you know, Washington, still doesn't really know how are we going to think about some of these key concepts, because we need to mature in terms of our understanding of the technology, some of the implications, what might be common ways of thinking about how do we measure performance, how do we measure health equity as it relates to AI. So anyway, I think that we want to make sure that we're taking the broad scope, but also recognizing that it's going to have to be something that is a living, breathing thing that needs to continuously be monitored and updated as we grow and learn.
Yeah, well, it's actually very reassuring to hear that that's the end goal, because if it was only items that could be delivered in the next few months, I imagine that would be so limited and that wouldn't be consistent with AI and how it's part of our society. Right. And so glad to hear that you have the lens that this will be infrastructure to handle these issues as they come up and to further develop your work streams as necessary in the years to come.
Yeah, and I think there's a danger in being overly prescriptive too early, right? And that's one of the things that we want to be very cautious of and cognizant of. I think we pretty strongly believe that judiciously applied public policy here can actually spur innovation, because there's a lot of concern, I know, in the healthcare delivery system in particular, but across the board, where are the guardrails here? And is there a way that we can at least think about those guardrails and work within those to have much more acceptance of the use of AI in ways that people start to trust more and more, which I think will actually spur innovation. So as I think about, you know, sort of the regulatory piece, I know certainly from the private sector side where I was before, you know, I'm new to the federal government pretty much. And so I was on the private sector side for a lot longer than I've been in the federal government. And I, you know, certainly appreciate the concern that, you know, regulation could be a wet blanket on this kind of innovation. I would argue that what we're trying to do is actually have the opposite effect, is that we want to think about how we can make sure that we've got a healthy, vibrant ecosystem of innovation here. And I'm more concerned that if we don't do something in this space, that we actually may not have a healthy, vibrant ecosystem, because there's no playing field for people to really understand, particularly because healthcare has so many idiosyncrasies, so many regulations and requirements that people really need to make sure that they have an understanding of as they think about these great new technologies.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I want to ask you a little bit more about some of the hazards. You mentioned a few, both with the biosafety and also the hazard of quelling innovation and finding that you're hampering the ability to use AI for good in the ways that you've talked about. And I know that you testified at the House Committee on Energy and Commerce on AI recently, and you touched on some of the shortcomings you've seen. Can you share with us some of the larger risks that you're worried about, that you're thinking about and planning for with regard to AI in the healthcare system?
Sure. Certainly issues related to safety. We've already seen that in the rollout of AI types of systems that may not be appropriate. Well, some may not be appropriate in general because they haven't gone through enough rigorous testing before being rolled out. Some may not be appropriate in particular settings. So they may be generally right, but specifically wrong. So it's a model developed on a training data set, for example, that is national in scope, or it was developed in one part of the country or developed with one particular set of demographics with respect to patients. And now it's going to be applied in a different area, and it may actually either be poor performing or have actually safety issues related to its use in that particular setting. So that's one set of considerations that I think is an important set of considerations. There's a whole other set of considerations related to health equity and unintended consequences that can flow from that. And again, there's been a lot of evidence about the potential unintended consequences from a health equity perspective that actually drove some of the regulatory approaches that we're taking at ONC that I'll describe in a second. But researchers like Ziad Obermeyer, for example, have published studies about the use of AI that determined resource allocations of care managers, for example, based on what was presumed to be patient complexity. And the models, it turned out, used cost as a proxy for healthcare complexity. And once you start to dive into that, you start to realize, well, wait a minute, cost in our healthcare delivery system is actually not a good proxy of complexity, because we don't have equal access to good health insurance. And so it turned out, once he started doing that research, that the algorithm was taking care management resources and recommending allocating those care managers to people who were seen as high complexity, but they were really just high cost. And that meant that they, by and large, had better insurance than people who were of equally high complexity, but didn't have good insurance and were lower cost. And it turned out that as he dug more and more into that, he found that the people who didn't get those resources ended up having poorer outcomes. So it was not only a missed opportunity, but it turned into negative consequences for large groups of patients. Fortunately, he identified that, and the organization that had rolled that out, which is a large health insurer, pulled it back, and I think they've reevaluated it. But that's just one example. And some of these examples seem really trivial, but then you realize it can have a profound effect. There are a whole set of AI-based tools that people think of as just administrative. It's like, well, that's just administrative. So we should just not even, don't even regulate those. Don't even think about those. Well, again, there's another example, documented example in peer-reviewed literature of hospital system in California that had rolled out a tool to help to optimize scheduling. And one of the things that it would do is based on experience, based on a bunch of data, it would predict the probability of a no-show of a patient. And for those who were deemed to have a certain level of probability of no-show, they would double or triple book the provider. Right? Because no-shows are a big issue, right? It's a waste of resource, waste of physician's time. We totally appreciate that. However, what that ended up doing was increasing the wait time for people who did show up. So begging the question of whether the algorithm was right or wrong, the reasons that someone might be a high probability for a no-show may be that they live in a rural area and they live 75 miles away from the nearest hospital. They may actually have very high transportation insecurity, or to say they have bad cars. They don't have access to public transportation. They only can travel via public transportation. And that's why they have a high probability of no-show. And I would argue that that's probably a group of people whose employers are highly intolerant of their calling in and saying, I'm going to be 2 hours late because it turns out that the doctor is double booked. That means that they either don't get paid for that time or they could lose their job. Unlike you and me, if we have an unexpected 2 hours, it's like, all right, well, I'm going to be late for work. Oh, well. All right. So I would argue that that actually poses a pretty high risk, you know, for those patients in terms of their quality of life. So those are the kinds of things that we're concerned about. Two things that I didn't mention, if I can, that weren't a part of the EO, but are important things for everyone to understand, is that the department, in addition to all the work that we're doing in the EO, we do have regulations that we put into place. The reason they're not in the executive order is because the executive order is about things that are new. The regulations that are in place or that were already underway as we developed the executive order, they're identified three quickly. One is already existing FDA approval of devices, and they have now approved over 700 devices that are in the category of software as a medical device. So AI-enabled tools, they're devices, but they're software. They've approved now over 700 of those, and you have to go through the FDA process for that. So that's one regulatory framework that helps us with safety and efficacy kinds of considerations and effectiveness sort of considerations. ONC published and released in December a new set of regulations related to the use of AI systems in electronic health records. And the requirement is to drive transparency about the AI systems that are in electronic health records so that provider organizations, as they consider the adoption and the use of these in patient-facing settings, have information available to them so that they can locally determine whether that particular model is appropriate to that particular setting. So unlike the FDA process, which is about approving yes or no, the ONC's approach is we're not approving. What we're trying to do is drive transparency. And then OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, has a draft rule related to non-discrimination in the use of clinical algorithms. Last point I'll make on the FDA ONC thing, and I know I've talked a lot, but the last point I'll make is that the way for people to think about how the FDA rule and the ONC rule fit together is, I like to think of the FDA rule as being kind of a foot wide and a mile deep. So if you are a medical device, whether software or hardware, in this case, software, if you meet the criteria of a medical device and you're going to be commercially marketed, now you're in FDA land and you have to go through that entire approval process, which is very rigorous, as most people will attest, in order to be able to market your product in the United States. The ONC rule is kind of the transpose of that. Instead of being a foot wide and a mile deep, it's actually a mile wide and a foot deep, because we do capture a lot more AI-enabled tools in our regulatory framework than the FDA approach does. And we also consider things like health equity, which aren't an explicit part of, you know, sort of the FDA process right now. But the regulatory approach is just about transparency. It's not about approval per se.
Well, thank you. You gave us a great vantage point to understand some of the many, many things coming out that we should be on the lookout for, that we'll benefit from, and that we should be supporting and understanding why they're important. So to drill down further on one of those points, and I know this is also part of your testimony, fortunately, you didn't leave Congress with just the fear and the doom that you were worried about. You gave some tools to help remedy some of these harms, such as algorithmic transparency. And I know you mentioned that that was one of the regulations talking about transparency. Can you tell us about what that looks like? Why is transparency so key in your mind? And what are some of the steps that you're requiring or that you'd like to see happening? And what are some of the other tools and resources we have available to help reduce some of the harms you talked about?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of dimensions to that. One is, if we think about this as being just another tool that provider organizations use in their decision-making. And in that context, you need to think about hospitals have formularies, right? They have committees that will sit and decide which medications are they going to allow in their hospital. And those are very explicit decisions they make based on their local consideration about a particular portfolio of drugs and medications they're going to make available. They make decisions all the time about what kind of decision support, what their electronic health record system is, what other kinds of devices they're going to make available in the hospital for the particular clinical practice that they have. And in that context, we think that AI-enabled tools should be thought of in the same way, that you need to give information to the providers so that they themselves are in a better position to decide whether this particular AI-enabled tool is appropriate for my patients. So in that sense, it's just empowering them to be able to make better decisions on behalf of and with their patients in a more informed way. The other part of it is that trust factor that we're hearing from a lot of clinicians, their concern about the black box that's embedded in their electronic health record system. And our concern, being AI optimists, was that that was going to be a barrier to adoption, that we might see too many clinicians who are saying, you know what, given the choice of this very simple clinical guideline that is very simple, but it's totally transparent to me how they came to the conclusion versus this black box that I know nothing about and is giving me recommendations, I'm going to go with the clinical guideline because at least I understand what's going on there. And especially because at the end of the day, I'm responsible as a clinician. So that was the other concern that we had, that if we didn't open up the black box a little bit, that it would be a barrier to adoption. And we really want these kind of tools to be adopted. So that was kind of the approach that we took. We also, the last concern that we had was what you might think of as an information asymmetry problem. And that was the concern that in a world where you can't determine what's a good system and a bad system, what will then happen is that people will choose the low-cost system because they have no ability to say, well, what am I getting for the higher price? And for the real academic wonks out there, this actually goes back to the famous article by George Akerlof, the economist that he won the Nobel Prize for, called A Market for Lemons. And it led to lemon laws and used car sales and all of that. But the basic concept was information asymmetry. It's if one party has all the information and the other party doesn't, it leads to a downward spiral in quality. And in this case, the downward spiral in quality in healthcare is a downward spiral in safety, a downward spiral in health equity, downward spiral in all sorts of considerations that are really important to us as a society. So that was the other reason that we thought it's really important to open this up. And hopefully that'll drive the opposite, which is competition and quality. People being able to demonstrate my model is actually higher quality than that model, and that's why you should purchase ours. We've talked to, you know, developers and innovators, venture capitalists, and looking at their companies, and they're kind of seeing this as a way for their companies to be able to market themselves in a better way by being able to say, look, O&C regulations are requiring that we provide 33 different types of data. If we're able to go to a provider and say, look, we've got all those 33 different types of data filled out, that's why you should trust our product over the next person's product. That's how we're seeing this as being market enhancing with respect to making a more efficient and vibrant market.
More people have more access to the information. They can become educated consumers. They can both understand what their data means and which tools to be using, which to deserve their trust.
And better explain it to their patients.
Makes so much sense. Well, I have so much more to ask you about, Mickey, but I know we have to be respectful of your time, considering how many things you just mentioned that you have underway. And so I will end this conversation with a final question that we ask all of our guests, and that is, looking ahead, what is the AI innovation that you are most excited to see come to fruition?
The one that I'm most excited to come to fruition is actually something we talked about, but just to double and triple down on that point, it's the availability of tools for patients to be able to get the information into their own hands and make sense of it in ways that are going to help them be better informed, help them be more engaged in their own healthcare, and for them to be more partners with their providers, but also outside of the sickness system, right? I think one of the things that our system is geared toward is thinking about healthcare as when you're sick. I think we want to broaden that to say, no, healthcare is about your entire life journey. The times that you're sick and in the hospital is just like the smallest sliver of how you should think about healthcare. And I think the opportunities that AI affords to be able to take that information, allow us to incorporate it into our life in more meaningful ways, I think is to me the most exciting opportunity here. That'll take time for it to develop, but I think it's here in front of us now.
Well, thank you for doing so much to lay the path to help us realize that important goal. Dr. Mukhi Tripathi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Subscribe to or download our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. We always welcome your feedback. And if you like the podcast, please rate us or give us a review. To learn more or get involved, visit us at www.equalai.org and www.weforum.org.
And a special thanks to NP Agency, without whom this podcast would not be possible.